Blog Talk Radio.
This is Cindy F. Solomon with the Global Product Management Talk. I was fortunate to attend Product Camp Austin number 8 over the weekend in Austin, Texas. I had an excellent time. It is a wonderful product management community. They are very enthusiastic. Next week we have Tom Evans speaking, who is from the Product Camp Austin community. Just a shout out to Product Camp Austin friends who are also frequent participants on the Global Product Management Talk. They sponsor the AIPMM. The Association of International Product Marketing and Management provides value to its individual members, corporate members, and sponsors by providing training, education, certification, and professional networking opportunities. As a matter of fact, tomorrow's webinar is on delivering new products to market and successfully commercializing them is never an easy task. The webinar provides 7 key tips to drive a commercially product to market. Based on the AIPMM's product management body of knowledge, ProdVac, we'll look at the different gates and tips for each that help conceive, plan, develop, qualify, and then finally launch, deliver, and retire products. You'll also learn what it takes from a software perspective to help deploy such a process out of the box. And the product management talk will be tweeting during that webinar. So you can follow the hashtag today, of course, during an audio event, as well as tomorrow during that webinar. Okay, and joining me today, I am delighted to introduce our speaker, Chris Williams of Blue Ferret Communications. Chris Williams is a professional copywriter. He switched from IT administration to copywriting in 2002. He is a freelance writer focused on web writing, creating content for websites, case studies, emails, and other marketing material. Along the way, he's written for everyone from tech companies to off-the-wall startups to defense contractors. He blogs about confusing content, which is the jargon-choked business pages that we all hate reading, as well as clear content, which is human language content that, surprise, surprise, actually markets well. Read his blog at www.blue-ferret.com. He is tweeting at Blue Ferret. We invite you to listen live to our podcast, which you can find at blogtalkradio.com/prodmanagementtalk, PRODMGMTTALK. And we're inviting people to answer our questions ahead of time or at any time on Twitter. And we will review Twitter to discuss your answers and comment during the live audio talk. Thanks to lots of feedback, as well as our co-host, BrainMate. We once again are iterating to guarantee that your experience and the value that you gain from participating in Global Product Management Talk continues to be valuable, and we invite your feedback. I'd like to introduce our co-host, Nick.
Hi, Cindy. Excited to be here again, and looking forward to a really good conversation with Chris, trying to take the jargon out of technology talk.
Excellent. We do have Kelly Burrows in the room, as well as John Newberry, who's coming in from London. All three of Ash Global NPD, Global New Product Development. Teresa Juergens-Cowell from Houston, Texas. So welcome. Chris, would you like to say a few words?
My goodness, after such an introduction. Well, as Cindy said before, my name is Chris Williams. I am a web writer, content developer, and editor. I was first introduced to what I call confusing content way back when I started as an IT admin. Didn't like it then, still don't, especially now that it flooded onto websites in the beginnings of the web. Things are a little better nowadays, but we still have a lot of, as Cindy very masterfully put it, cryptic web content out there. We've all seen it. We've all been confused by it. So I'll be talking today about the problems that I see with it, ways we can stomp it out, and why what I think is of as clear content should win out.
Okay, so I will attempt to tweet while you're talking. Yes.
As will I.
As will we all, it looks
right.
Like.
First question that we had posted is Q2, because Q1 is always, please introduce yourself, where you're tweeting from, and your involvement with product management. And so Q2 is, what was the last business web page that you saw that read like a human being wrote it?
Like a human being wrote it.
Right.
The first thing that comes to my mind, now mind you, this was not this was a technical service. It is not a product management website, but it was the website for Spotify, the new music service that's been doing incredibly well, I believe, in the UK, and it's just made a debut here in the US. I use Spotify as an example for one of my more recent blog posts because their website was entirely written as though it was one person sitting next to you talking about the service. That was the voice throughout every single page of the website, from the home page to the help section to the product descriptions. That was at Spotify.com. It's still there. It should still be consistent. It's been doing incredibly well, and I think in no small part due to the fact that it is so human language, easy to read.
And so when I go there now, it's directing me to a few different places, and it's a lot of links. I'm not seeing any direct discussion, but it is effective.
Yes.
I guess if I go to What is Spotify? A World of Music Awaits. Think of Spotify as your new music collection, your library. Only this time, your collection is vast, millions of tracks and counting. Spotify comes in all shapes and sizes. So it is speaking to what I would care about.
Exactly. This is, in some forms, an iTunes competitor. So they are up against a very, very powerful system. Obviously, they have to use whatever edge they can. And they chose to use an edge in the voice of their content. And it appears to be working very well. I don't have exact numbers. I don't know anybody at the Spotify team. All I know is that whoever they have doing their writing is doing a very good job and should keep going.
The two that I like, the one that we use regularly, Brainmates, is for our newsletters, is MailChimp, which has a really fun, playful overall feeling and attitude that extends all the way through their every bit of communication they put out. And the other one I like is one called Mantax, which I don't know if you've heard of. It's a fun way for gentlemen to acquire new underwear.
I have heard about it, but I didn't know what the reference was.
And again, their demographic or their target market very well and has fairly casual communication, but again, it doesn't talk about, you know, how they go about it, the technology behind it. They just communicate as if they're talking to you about their product and about what your needs were as a customer.
As I think should be the central focus. There's always a place for wanting to explain the mechanics of something. If someone is curious about that, then of course there should be content that will address those questions. However, that's not usually the number one question that people have when they go to a website. They want to know the classic, what's in it for me? What do I get out of this? How does this satisfy the problem that I have? And that's what clear content website should address immediately and repeatedly. Which apparently from your description, they're doing their job.
Absolutely.
Great web content doesn't discuss how the product is made or even what it does, just what the customer cares about.
Initially, yes. There is a lot of value in the education as content strategy. I have many colleagues who are in the specific industry of content strategy. They address that very, very frequently. It's always good to be able to educate, but it doesn't necessarily need to be right away. Right away, someone has a problem. They're visiting your website to look for a solution for that. So that should be the first thing you answer.
Great. So I want to go back to MailChimp, and I want to say that I do use them, and they carry through that down-to-earth and humorous tone of voice in every aspect of it. And they have continued to get more and more complex and offer really excellent features for developing email newsletters and tracking the customers and really making them quite complex. So through every aspect, they continue that tone of voice saying, don't worry, don't get overwhelmed, you can do this, as well as their icon, the chimp, is very friendly.
I have worked with MailChimp as well in the past for a few clients. They are usually the top email marketing service that I will recommend just because they are that easy to use and the voice is that engaging. The system is powerful and extremely well laid out, but it's that consistent voice throughout the whole thing. It makes the entire experience not only easy but a lot of fun to use.
And I think that they've managed that delicate balance of keeping things simple without dumbing it down.
Exactly, yeah. So it's perfect.
Which is also challenging.
That is its own challenge right there. To make the complex easy, that you really have to try to make sure your content will do that well. And I have yet to speak with MailChimp's writers, but they are doing exactly that.
Great. Now, to go back to Manpack.
Yep.
That's a new one on me, I have to say.
And it's coming out of Canada. So do you want to tell us more about it, Nick?
Sure. Well, it got my attention with one of the taglines I saw quite a while ago, which was, because you've got better things to do. And straight away, the boiling down of that communication was, instead of me as a customer having to wait in the queue at a department store to buy socks and underwear and address that problem in one clear statement, got my attention. And that's really the first stage that most product communication really needs to get out there. What's the key problem that a product is trying to solve? And that tagline, that one piece of communication, actually hit the nail on the head. I didn't want to spend time waiting in a queue, and it got my attention enough to then find out about the product, which is essentially a subscription service to buy a couple of pairs of underpants and a couple of pairs of socks every 2 to 3 months on subscription, delivered to my door without having to think about it.
Sorry.
This is great, yeah.
I'm sure it was developed by a girlfriend.
Considering it has a girlfriend approved sticker on the front page right next to the
girlfriend-approved.
These guys definitely know their target audience, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Because who's going to buy the subscription? It will be the girlfriend.
We might forget.
Whatever it takes.
Right. Or the wife. Okay. Oh, boy.
That for later.
That is great. And I will say that I have noticed on new startups, new products, there is more and more this tone of voice and this recognition that they're talking direct to consumer. And MailChimp is a B2B service. I would think that most of their, a majority of their clients are B2B.
I agree. I
think interesting to note that there's more and more a recognition that even into a B2B sale, that who is doing the buying within that B is a human being.
Yes, and that's a very important point when you were talking about startups just a moment ago. A lot of the startups, especially here in California, in Silicon Valley, recognize that even though they're doing a startup and it's a new experience and they're trying out something all that's never been done before, that and we're going into up against these large competitors with big budgets and so on, they're still talking one person to one person. So using this kind of tone has incredible power on a website. It bypasses the old standard of highbrow, jargon-laced language that was descended from on high and coming from the 40s and 50s mass advertising days. The entire market has getting close to rejecting all of that and taking on a more individual approach because it is so easy to approach each individual through various channels on the web.
It would be great to hear from people in corporate environments. They might be restricted from adopting such a tone. Is there a concern from legal or a policy issue that they have to maintain some kind of a conservative, traditional tone of voice?
You are correct, and I do encounter that very often, most often from either a legal department or from upper management or C-level positions, people who have been in this industry doing their work for decades. They knew what worked 20 years ago, and they still want to use that today because they think it still works. This is a very, very difficult problem to surmount when it comes to web content because you're trying to explain something entirely new in an entirely new language to someone who has had no preparation and no warning that they would need to switch the language. So there's a whole lot of pushback from those departments, from legal departments, from C-levels, upper management. They want to stick with what they believe still works, not recognizing that the very medium under which they are thinking is no longer there.
Yes, and I encountered this, even 10 years ago with the beginning of the web being embraced as a marketing medium. And I think I was telling you about how when I was at FileMaker early on and their website was purely for tech support and they didn't think that anybody else would care to look at the website and certainly wouldn't care about deep technical issues surrounding the product. There was a lot of fear, even back then, of putting any content on the web, let alone addressing the customers directly.
There's still a lot of that fear that goes on now. It's mostly in the form of the corporate secret. You always hear about the elusive corporate secret, whether it's some intellectual property that they won't show you, or it's some hidden process that they won't tell you about. They're deathly afraid that this will get out onto the web, and then all their competitors will hear about it and then adopt their processes. They're not discounting the fact that maybe their competitors might have a better process. I don't know. But anyway, so they're deathly afraid of putting this information on websites. And on that, I tend to quote Brian Clark, the founder of CopyBlogger, and an incredibly eminent copywriter, who would say, I'm slightly paraphrasing here, but give information until it starts to hurt, and that's about the right point to be.
Until it hurts you to be that transparent?
Exactly.
Okay.
Surprisingly enough, that actually works incredibly well for one simple reason. People tend to be lazy. You can tell someone how a process works. You can give them 0.1 all the way to 0.10, every single bit of information, and a large percentage of the time, they will come to you and say, I appreciate your telling me how this works. Would you please do it for me? Because I don't have the time, or I don't understand this particular step here, and you must understand that because you're the one telling me about it.
So that's interesting, and that totally syncs with recently a designer from Marketo talk about designing B2B products, as a matter of fact, using a human voice, and his point was that people don't like to read. So that totally is in sync with your saying that people are lazy. To flip it to a positive side, I think that just people are inundated. They're really busy working. The last thing that they need to do is to take time to figure out what we're trying to tell them. If we want them to do something, we have to make it easy and enjoyable for them to do it. Otherwise, they'll be distracted or they'll be on to the next thing.
Very true.
I think that's a really important point for me, that it's not that people don't want to read, but they don't want to be bored. They want to have to read something that they have to read to get something done. I think where sites like MailChimp and the Manpack example that I showed you really stand out is that they're actually fun to read. Even though they're conveying their marketing message and their product information, it's actually entertaining to step through a lot of their blogs and their postings and their instructional information rather than it being dry information. You actually want to keep reading rather than feeling like you have to.
Exactly. On the Converse example, we've all read, we've gone into the gigantic tech websites, Cisco, IBM, Microsoft. If you have to read any of the support material that they have, it is some of the driest, most draining content you will ever come across. It's so full of jargon referencing the jargon that goes over here, and so on and so forth, endlessly back and forth. Obviously, these are talking about extremely complex systems, but you still feel like your eyes are falling out of their sockets when you're reading it. It's not the kind of thing you want to put on a brand new startup's homepage.
No, no. I mean, in the office, we've been actively looking at moving to a SharePoint solution for a lot of our file management.
Mm.
And while we're actively trying to buy their product, it's almost impossible to work out what the heck the product actually is.
Yes. Yes, I've seen that many a time. SharePoint is a great example. It's an extremely powerful system, but knowing reading the documentation, you wouldn't quite be sure of that. Sometimes you think, what the heck did this say? I don't understand, and I just read it twice.
Hmm. I see a lot of content that doesn't give context. It might be simplified, but it jumps in assuming you've had three paragraphs of foundation to understand what they're talking about. So if you did have that three paragraphs of foundation, you would understand and appreciate what they're saying?
It's an indication that the company who posted that probably had the specialist who's in charge of that write the content instead of having a writer for it. Obviously, the specialist knows the material. They know that system. So wouldn't they be the logical choice to write about it? Well, yes and no. Yes, and the fact that obviously they have all the information they would need in their brain or at their fingertips, they would be able to tell someone specific details that would answer the customer's question at any point in the sales cycle. But no, in the sense that they are so close to the subject matter that they may miss something that someone else would need as you say, the foundational approach. They would assume that you already know something because they already know it, so they don't write it down. Their content then becomes what's called, used in literary terms, in media res, in the middle of things. In a sales cycle, jumping in the middle of things doesn't really work.
Kelly Burrows made a great comment on Twitter. She said, let and enable people to build relationships. It is a much more genuine way of communicating.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
As well as earlier, Michelle Besner, who is from Rhyme Attack, had retweeted what Nick had said, which is the communications challenge is to make the complex simple without treating the reader like an idiot.
Yes, yes, very much so. It's a little bit of a challenge to make sure you can boil the complex down without treating a reader like an idiot. But it's not so complex that it only takes a certain expert over here to do it. It really isn't that challenging, so long as you have the research in front of you, what your audience is itself. And that's a major point that I see with this, a major foundational reason why so many people resist a casual human voice as opposed to the traditional conservative jargon-laced content. They fall back on that because it doesn't have to be specific. It doesn't have to be targeted as much. They don't have to know as much about their target market. It's just easier to go about that. Going through and doing user research, finding out what these individuals are like, what they encounter every day, the types of content they enjoy reading, the voice they understand. This takes more time and more effort to produce the content. Oftentimes, companies won't justify that amount of time. They don't think it has as much of an ROI. They tend to view it as a cost center instead of a benefit.
Let me capture that. So companies consider what a cost center?
Producing content itself. Oftentimes, companies will invest a lot of money into a good website or designing a series of white papers or producing an email marketing campaign. They will put the money into making sure that they have a good list, that they have a good service provider like MailChimp, that they have the design is all appropriate, that they're segmenting. But they won't put as much money, if anything, into the content itself. They see that as, well, we'll just put something in. They don't want to do an extra bit of user research that would tell them things like the voice that their target market would like to hear, the points that they are looking for solutions to right now. This is not a real challenge, especially with the huge amount of information that customers are exchanging online. But more traditional, more conservative, older companies won't do that because they don't see these avenues as being worthwhile.
Right, and this is what I'm finding also. As a matter of fact, there was a discussion at Product Camp Austin about the future of product management and product marketing. And I said, product marketers really need to look at content strategy, content management. As a matter of fact, the conversations I'm hearing from people who are involved in content management, information management, knowledge management, they're dealing with challenges and issues that product marketers have been traditionally dealing with, which is listening to the market and creating content about the product that speaks to who the users are and who the market buyers are. We had a little bit of a debate about that, and I noticed that people who understood content totally embraced that this was an issue, whereas traditional product management people didn't see the distinction at all.
Yeah, it's a real challenge to make this distinction, and it's I sort of hesitate to call it a generational difference, but it seems to be the most appropriate term. We look at younger companies, newer companies, that will take advantage of all the communication channels that they have and put effort into producing the content that speaks to the readers on their levels. Older companies, companies that have been around, say, pre-web, or I guess that's a better way to say it, pre-web companies, yes, they are more resistant to adapting their content to a more human language format. It shows in a lot of the differences between the sales cycles, between their audiences growing or shrinking.
Welcome at Pug F. Rodriguez, who is from Boulder, Colorado. who's come into the room.
Ha, Pug. I love the icon, the avatar.
Yes. I think that we may have skipped to Q4, which is, should business content use a formal or an informal voice? I think we have definitely been speaking to that. We had listed Q3. When you see a web page or email choked by jargon and stiff language, do you accept it as just another business necessity, or do you go somewhere else? Kelly Burrows retweeted that people don't spend enough research and effort to create clear communications, but they will spend on the graphic design.
Yes.
Actually, I will say that it's good that they're paying attention to design, because
yes,
people respond to that. Case in point is the popularity of Pinterest, which is all about graphics. I've tried to put together a Pinterest for product management issues, and coincidentally, product management blogs, articles, and information don't have a lot of graphics on them.
I'm in full agreement about the graphics being so important and a good layout being a very valuable part of any kind of marketing effort. For one very, very simple and very useful reason, graphics and a good layout not only present the content well, but they help to guide the reader's eye down through the entire piece, and thus down through the content. I was working on an email marketing piece just the other day. It was advertising a new service that was being introduced. It was using a screenshot of a website and an image of a customer performing the service. The screenshot was well appropriated. It had good size. It was positioned well. It wasn't overwhelming the content at all. You could read right down. Everything was there to say. It went well. But the image of the person using the service was larger, and it was intruding. It was bulking through part of the content so that the content had to bend around it. That's not a good example of design. The good layout was not present there. It was overwhelming the content. Now, if the email was intended to present that graphic, then, of course, that would succeed. But if it was intended to present content in a way that you wanted someone to read it and act on it, well, then layout didn't work in that case. Just one example. But I agree that the layout, the graphic design, and the content must always work together. They are two parts of the entire presentation. So I think we wandered away from the question we were going for.
Yes, I think we did, which is
Well, here, let me continue and answer the actual question. The question was, when you see a web page or email choked by jargon and stiff language, do you accept that it's just another business necessity, or you do go somewhere else? Now, it used to be that most readers and most customers would accept this, simply because there was no alternative. Early days of the web, pre-web, that you often did not have an alternative choice if you wanted a certain product. However, nowadays, because of the advent of the web, and in part because of the advent of social media, we can find alternatives to almost everything now, often with much less effort. Also, the younger generations, the ones who use these new tools like social media and online marketing, they don't have the same interest and the same vested interest in putting up with jargon and stiff language and all these other old business necessities. They don't want to put it up with, as Nick said earlier, boring reading, excessively long stuff that they really don't want to go through. They want to have an answer to their problem right away. Instant gratification has become a positive. What do you know?
Excellent. Kelly Burrow says that stiff language would make her leave. She doesn't enjoy talking to people who use stiff language, but she will if she has to. However, when reading, she has a choice.
Yes, and that is a very powerful point to make in all situations on the web. Everyone has a choice whether or not to read your website. Now, if they're talking to you face-to-face, they may be polite, and even if they're bored or if they don't like what's going on, they may sit and be polite and listen to you, at least until you finish. There is no such expectation on the web. If you have stiff language that will bore or drive away readers on your website, guess what? They're hitting the back button. They're going someplace else, and they can now.
I think the other thing that happens when people are using stiff language is they're simply reporting the facts, and people don't necessarily want just the facts. They want to have the context, and they want to understand why it's important to them. And I think that to make that communication effective, businesses need to really focus on who they believe their customers are, understand what would make that communication effective, understand what those value propositions really are, and then frame their communication accordingly. So for some people, that stiff language might be very important. Actually, it might be appropriate for that particular target market. But for most target markets, just reporting the facts isn't going to be an effective way of communicating.
Agreed. It's the old features versus benefits equation. Goes on. It's been an old sales truism for a long time now. It's always good to have facts available if, as you say, there is an audience that wants to see that. There's always a place for that kind of content when people request it. Oftentimes you'll find this in support documents or in detailed product descriptions. Someone will ask for these things. They'll want to get the old dragnet thing. Just the facts, man. They just want these in so they can turn it into their own presentation or take that to their boss and say, look, here are the facts. Here's what we got out of this. That's great. There's always a place for that. However, as you said, people will want to also understand what's in it for them, what benefits they derive from these facts. And that is a different presentation. That is a different type of content. And that is what we should be using on our websites and our marketing efforts.
Excellent. Does the law put a barrier on how informal web content can be? We do have a product manager in the community, Erica L. Anderson, who used to be a lawyer. Shout out to Erica from Utah. This is also something that's discussed in social media. Legal departments are very concerned about what is being tweeted and what is being shared. However, the tone of voice, I don't know that that's a legal issue, is it?
I don't think it's a legal issue, but it is one that legal departments may want to weigh in on. Obviously, when you're dealing with legal issues, legal restrictions, state regulations, what have you, you must review web content to make sure that it's consistent, it's not giving away IP, it's not treading on any legal lines. That's important, and it should not be taken away from. In that respect, the law may put a barrier on the content itself. However, using an informal voice really isn't an issue unless a legal department wants to make it one. Oftentimes, see, every department, every individual has their own writing voice, including legal departments. They may want to write content or edit content presented to them in a manner consistent with what they typically write, their own legal documentation. Now, we've all seen how long and how stuffy all possible liabilities covered those documents can be with legal, which works fine for them. But chances are pretty good you don't want your audience reading any of that at all. The best thing to do for that is aim for a good balance between what the content says and how it says that. Make sure that legal departments are okay with what the content says. Make sure, run it by them. Make sure you're not giving something away you should. But don't let the legal department determine the voice of the content itself, how it says what it's saying. If you allow that to happen, well, then you'll have a legal website. Might as well chase your customers out the door with a club. The result is the same.
Okay. So you said aim for good balance between what you're saying and how it's said.
Precisely.
Great. Nick was answering, even if you are informal, you still need to be accurate and true. In fact, communications can benefit by jargon removal.
Yep. Indeed they can, and often are.
Nick, I really thought that you would be arguing on the side that certain things required technical explanation and that there were certain aspects of product management that could not be simplified.
Look, I'm going to probably disappoint you, Cindy, because I think there are some people who really crave the technical understanding of things, and that's fine once you have their attention, once they have an interest in your product, for them to try and develop that understanding. And I think, as Chris indicated, there's a big difference between sort of that initial communication and education. Some people are seeking that education. And even with that, even though the concepts may be quite technical, obscuring them with an abundance of jargon and actually making it a challenge for people to have successfully understood what the heck you're talking about isn't necessarily the objective of clear communication. So first, people need to buy into your product, and I think we do need to make that value proposition very clear to begin with. Once people have bought into your product idea, then they may want to learn more. And then, as I think we also mentioned before, we should be tailoring our message to suit those people. So I actually like to think about almost three layers of communication style. There's the initial marketing communications, which is to get people to pay attention and simply grab them by the throat and say, hey, this is important to you, come and have a listen. The second level is, now let me tell you a little bit about the product and why it will add value to you in your world, now that we've got your attention. And the third level is, if you really want to understand how this works and you've got a bit of a technical bent, then come this way and we'll explain it to you in excruciating detail. But each one of those has a different target market and a different type of a person that you're communicating to.
And if I can add on to this very excellent point, that each of those levels of communication may in fact target different individuals in the same company. It may be that you are addressing initially a different person than the more technical person who would want the details. For example, you may have a department manager who makes the first contact on the website. He wants to know the benefits to the situation. He wants to know how your product will solve his problem. He then passes this website to his subject matter expert. This person wants technical details. They want to know how the solution works. They want to know the features, the facts. That person then goes to, say, the VP who needs approval. The VP needs to know ROI numbers, specifics on operation. They need to know all the supply chain details. They need the excruciating detail all the way down. Three people, one company, three different target markets, one website. Bang! Yeah, you made an excellent distinction there, Nick. There are many people who do want very technical information. And if your research determines that you have those people in your audience, by all means, give them that information. But don't assume that they're the only people who are listening. And don't assume that they are the first people who will come across the site.
I think in my experience, I've worked with a lot of security products. And security can be a very technical product. And at the top level, customers just want to know that a particular type of security product will protect their security or their password or their investment or whatever it might be.
Of course, immediate gratification, yeah.
Then the kind of the next level is, well, how will it do that and what will be the cost to me in terms of effort or money to do that? And then the last bit is for the people who care or the people who really want to verify that security will be exactly how are you going about it.
How do you bring me the results that you have already shown that you present? How do you get to my results? Yeah.
Yeah. How do you stack up under scrutiny?
Yep. So these are the same questions, and the content must answer them. And the best way that it can answer them is by doing so in a human language, face-to-face. When you start off, you're talking to the person. Then, as they want more details, you put them in.
Excellent. Q7 was, if large companies stick to using business speak and jargon on their websites, will it hurt them in the future?
There's a degree of inertia to speak of here. Large companies are almost by definition slow to respond and slow to change. As I said before, the ROI on content development is not always consistently measured. And there's with larger companies who've been around, say, pre-web, there's something of a set it and forget it mentality when it comes to creating content. They will tend to create a set of content, put it on the website, and forget about it for a few months. They won't bother with actually using it as though it were sort of a more live, real-time instrument. That mentality really does hurt a large company. For one, in marketing, because for one, you're not responding to marketing challenges as they arise. Technology has existed for a while to measure marketing ROI on almost real-time and to be aware of changes in an industry as they occur. Tremendous marketing opportunities that exist that pop up almost out of nowhere that companies who will stick to using jargon-laced business-speak content may not be able to take advantage of even if they see them. And there's a second level to this that really hurts jargon-laced content, but it's not in marketing. It's in support. If a company uses jargon-heavy content in, say, their support documentation, product briefs, their white papers, if that's all written in business more and more, especially as time goes on, people won't read it. They don't have the time or the patience to, as we were talking about earlier, sit down and read boring stuff. Kelly said she'll just leave. But what if she still needs an answer to her question? What is she going to do? Oftentimes, they will call the company themselves and ask support staff. Asking support staff questions that their content was supposed to answer, all you're doing there is people are taking up your support staff's time, draining away productivity every single day, whose financials are bleeding on the back end. That's a major source of pain. And it's only going to get worse.
an example of different types of communication at different levels. There is a product that I use called LastPass for password management, and it's got some really useful communication, again, as Chris mentioned, using graphics and short blocks of text to communicate the different values and features. But if you want to know about the technology piece, if you want to know what's under the hood, then there's a more formal style of writing for that piece of information.
I've used LastPass. It's an excellent software package, so I understand why they would take that approach. It conveys benefits immediately and still leaves technical information for those of us like me who like understanding how something works or who may need to have assurances that their security is protected by this application. That's a great example.
And it's LastPass, LastPass?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Our Q8 is, would the voice of a website's content, the web page case study white paper, influence your decision on whether or not to work with that company?
Well, let me give a general example here. It's very common for business reps to do research on several prospective vendors, each of them offering the product or service they need before they ever make any contact with any of them. The vendor itself at that point has basically zero influence on that stage of the buying cycle, but their content does. It can make them stand out from the others in that list by conveying a clear message and a clear value. It even influences the SEO and whether or not they find their content during the research process. So if the content uses a clear language, if it speaks to the person, if it goes beyond what a competitor may use, which would be jargon-laced content, and it shows up in the research stage and stands out from the others, then it's doing marketing work well before the company ever even knows that client is out there. So how much influence is that?
Excellent.
Well, this has been a really good discussion, and one that, unfortunately, Cindy, I haven't been as controversial as I might have been in other discussions. Because to me, the value of clear communication is so often wasted when businesses quite passionately share the technical capabilities and the features of their product and neglect to spend the time on actually understanding what their customers want to hear.
I have to agree with Nick. Many of my clients will have pages upon pages of interesting information about their products. They'll have all manner of examples. They may even have case studies or testimonials, but they don't have information on what their target market actually wants. I've actually gone to clients, asked them, what is your target market for this, and how do they like to communicate with you? And they couldn't answer the question. They didn't know. They had done no research. They assumed that the old style of content, the old jargon business speak content, what I call confusing content, would work because that's what everybody else did and that's what will work for the rest of the time. The people who wrote that, who created that model, who used jargon to make themselves look more important, to control the alternatives, they never figured on the web.
That's right. And it's about time. I mean, they've had 10 years to catch up.
I've had longer than that, and still an uphill battle.
I think one of the other things that web writing and writing for online environments has really changed is the frequency of communication. So the pre-web communication, you would spend significant time making sure it was all correct. You'd pack as much information into a printed brochure as you could. Then you'd print 10,000 copies of that copy brochure, and you would ship that around with your sales stuff wherever you go. With the web, you can change that in moments. With the web, you can update it on a daily basis with a completely different cost structure. And
yeah.
I think that is something with the writing styles haven't necessarily adapted as well.
Yes, the style is not so much in use because the underlying environment has not yet adapted to that kind of communications approach. In time, and as more businesses come about, we see it with the newer startups, it will change and it should improve greatly. As you say, it'll become more real-time, more engaging, less jam-packed full of the raw facts, and more engaging on a personal and human language level.
Excellent. So web content will become more real-time, more engaging, and less jam-packed with jargon, more human as time goes by, which I think is not quick enough.
I'll agree with you there.
As a matter of fact, gosh, it might have been 12 years ago that Regis McKenna, big name in advertising, wrote a book called Real Time about the customer wanting information immediately. And what a visionary that he was talking about that so long ago, and we're still struggling to make that a real experience.
Yeah, it's still a challenge. challenge and pre-web and post-web distinction I was making earlier, I think, is a big factor in that, where we have companies that are still, that have marched along with their older approaches for decades, maybe even centuries. It'll be extremely difficult for them to adapt. Some will adapt, some may not. But those that do adapt will make better use of the web and better use of their content. And in turn, they'll see better market success than those who don't.
Excellent. And in closing comments, Kelly Burrows says that another factor is the informal way of communication in social media. I think it has made informal more expected in all content. Very good point, Kelly.
Yeah, that's a very good point there, yes. The informal style that essentially social media began with in the very beginning has produced a sea change throughout the web with all the integrations into new types of content that are coming about and new types of content that will come from here. We're not even done with seeing how many forms content will take in the near future.
That's right. Talk about also what we didn't even touch upon, writing for mobile.
Oh boy, we could go another hour.
Well, then, please come back. That's certainly an issue that product managers need to be concerned with, that all of their products and everything we're developing is going to mobile devices and needs to be cross-platform. Thank you so much, Chris Williams, for joining us today. Thank you, Nick Koster, for being the co-host. Please follow Chris at Blue Ferret, as well as Nick Koster at BrainMate. Coming up next week is Tom Evans.
Thanks for having me on. Nick, Cindy, it was good to talk with you guys. It was a really good discussion.
A pleasure.
I'd be very interested in coming back on and talking about mobile content, if you'd like.
Excellent. An Android app, Prod Management Talk, that it gets streamed out to. Please follow Product Management Talk during the week, sponsored by the AIPMM. Thank you, Kelly Burrows, who says thanks, everyone, for an enjoyable session. Transcript will be available. Thanks, Nick and Chris.
A pleasure. Thank you, guys.